This week on the Linux Action Show, a new version of Mandriva for flash drives is out. We take a look at the possible new KDE 4 file manager, and it's great. The Barrel and Compiz projects begin to officially merge, and Novell speaks out on its position on the new GPL3 draft. Plus, the Classmate PC designed for Windows CE got a heck of a lot more Linux this week. Then, we interview the big guy himself, Mark Shuttleworth, founder of the Ubuntu Project. Not to be outdone by Mark, we take some of your listener questions and feedback. Plus, so much more, all this week on the Linux Action Show! Welcome to episode 42 for Sunday, April 8th, 2007. And with you, as always, listeners, is Chris. Hey, listeners. Enterprise Google Earth servers run Linux. And Enterprise Google Linux is, of course, the version of Google Earth that Google resells to companies that want to have Google Earth data in-house, probably with their own custom stuff overlaid. I had a listener send me this. I thought it was pretty cool. It's basically Google Earth servers that you run at your local location, and they have to run either Red Hat or SUSE, and which is just awesome, because I just love it when big companies like Google require Linux instead of Windows. That, for me, is fantastic. Before we get to the news this week, I wanted to talk a little bit. I wanted to muse with the listeners about some of the recent issues and vulnerabilities in Microsoft's most secure operating system ever, Windows Vista. I know we don't usually typically talk about Windows and stuff on the show too much out of context of a news story, but I just thought this would be a good one. First of all, last week we had the issue with the animated cursor vulnerability, where an animated cursor, if you view an HTML email or a web page in IE, could run arbitrary code on your PC, which is when you're on your Windows PC, which is just crazy to think that a cursor vulnerability could do that, that it could affect you all the way. Then it comes out that, people started asking, why do I have to restart my Vista machine to fix an animated cursor problem? Well, then Microsoft spokesman said, well, there's also some other fixes in there that fix some kernel mode stuff that we went ahead and put in there too, so you have to reboot. So then it turns out they're sneaking in fixes into this cursor vulnerability, so we don't know what else they fixed, which is always shady, and it's harder to support those kind of things. And as a direct result of this, we're now seeing things like the Realtek audio driver is being broken by a cursor vulnerability. I mean, you install a patch for a cursor and it breaks your sound card driver? That is ridiculous. So, and then I just saw on Slashdot that they have a way to bypass the Windows protected modes, so you can put malware and spyware into protected mode, which means that things like spyware removal tools and antivirus aren't going to be able to touch these processes, which is very scary, and it's going to potentially bring a whole new generation of malware on the Windows platform. So if these kind of things keep panning out like this, we're going to see more and more people switching to Linux. So, and then, of course, that means more Linux Action Show listeners. Also, let's get a bit of good news. Not really Linux news, but I thought I'd touch on it. This week, actually the day I'm recording, April 7th, is the official birth of the internet in the form of an RFC. In April 7th, 1969, the first request for comment was sent out basically what was going to eventually end up to be the internet. So that's pretty cool, I thought. All right, listeners, let's do the news. First news story on our news docket for this week is Mandriva. Mandriva has announced 4-gig flash version of Mandriva's distribution meant to be installed on USB thumb drives. They have a 2 gig version, which is sort of slimmed down. But this 4 gig version actually turns out to be a fairly full desktop. I'll link to the story in the show notes. But on a 4 gig flash drive, you can have KDE 3.5.4, Firefox, OpenOffice, GIMP, Real Player, Flash Player, and of course a bunch of other stuff. It's it's a little bit older version of Firefox. It's version 1.5, but still perfectly usable. This is talk about the ultimate portable computing. If you have a system, if you can sit down in a system that boots off a USB flash, then stick those guys in, boot off that. You have your own custom environment everywhere you go. I love that idea. I just wish I had more systems that could boot off USB, because a lot of the systems that I use, they don't seem to offer that, even though they're fairly newer systems. Speaking of KDE, they had a first look at Dolphin, the KDE 4 file manager. It's going to be a suggested replacement for Conker in terms of just browsing the file system. It has some screenshots, which I kind of suggest people check out and see if you kind of agree with me on where I'm going with this. But I don't want to start any flames here, but I really do kind of think that the new proposed KDE file manager looks a heck of a lot like Nautilus, possibly a cross between Nautilus and the OS X Finder, which is not necessarily a bad thing, because it seems to kind of taken some of the best of both things and made a really nice file manager. I actually really dig this file manager. It's one that I could get behind. It's because Conker is great. It's super powerful, but it's got so many buttons and toolbar options and menu options that it's like, whew. You know, when you're trying to do a simple task like browse your file system, it's a little overkill. But it's got a very nice, renders icons very nicely. It's got the sidebar like Nautilus has, where you have your home listed and your other like short places. It also does, I think, what Microsoft coins the breadcrumb thing in Vista, where and now Nautilus essentially does it too. But as you browse through the file structures, there's a little icon that pops up that kind of you can click back and go immediately back to that part. Vista users know what I'm talking about, and then of course people that use Nautilus have had this too. It's the little buttons as you click in subfolders you get. Overall, it's looking very nice, and I actually kind of hope this does make it to be the default file manager in KDE 4. Big news that we broke about maybe 2-3 weeks ago is we were talking about the proposed merger of Compiz and Barrel. Well, it looks like the team has officially announced that they're going to be merging the two together. So Barrel and Compiz will once again become one. It looks like, from what I've gathered, is Compiz will essentially be used for the core of the rendering effects. And then what they're going to do is take some of the really great plugins that Barrel had developed over the time, and those are going to go into what they're going to be temporarily called, and it might be the final name, is Composite Community. And the Composite Community is going to be some of the neat stuff from Barrel, like I said, like the effects and maybe some of the management tools. What we're going to end up with is a best of both worlds breed, in my mind. You're going to get the cool effects with the stable, complete core of Compiz. I just really think this is a huge win for the Linux desktop. And in my interview later in the show with Mark Shuttleworth, we go ahead and touch on that. So very exciting news, and it's going to be a story that we will continue to follow, because obviously there's a big love for Barrel and Compiz on this show. Novell had a little bit to say this week about the GPL 3 draft. Last week we touched on that there was a new draft coming out, and we sparked some controversy about that. We shot our mouths off about a few things, and some people gave us lots of feedback, which is great. So Novell has done a, I think it's essentially like they called their open PR. It's like a blog for talking to the community through a PR channel. And basically, Novell's position can be summed up as this. Novell's going to continue to distribute Linux. Nothing's going to change, because all of the code they're distributing is GPL2. And the new draft, nothing in the new draft, they say, will also inhibit Novell's ability to include GPL3 technologies in SUSE Linux and OpenSUSE. They say this is, again, a reminder to people, this is just an open draft that's available for comment, and Novell intends to make public comment on that, so they're going to go through those processes. And they say that they continue to be firmly committed to their continuing partnership with Microsoft, and that they think this is a good thing, and they basically are going to be fully compliant with the terms of licenses for the software that they ship, including software licensed under the GPL3. So take that as it is. I don't even know what that means, listeners, but you probably do because you're smarter than I am. And they just reiterate that they're a strong supporter of open source software, the kind of things that you typically hear. Interesting. It's definitely a story worth following, which we will, but I guess as the GPL3 continues to shake out, people are going to be looking at Novell specifically to see how they react to this entire process. Everybody that listens to the show is probably familiar with the one laptop per child project, which is the cheap, you know, around $100 notebook that runs Linux that can be given to developing nations and other things like that. And then we touched on that last week there has been some communication about they might sell a $200 version to sell to schools and to citizens and that aren't that don't qualify for the $100 program. They also, though, there's been a building competitor to the one laptop per child, which is called the Classmate PC. And my understanding, which this may be wrong, but my understanding was that the Classmate PC was essentially started by Intel and Microsoft, because the one laptop per child machine uses AMD processors. Well, Intel wanted a piece of the processor market, and Microsoft wanted a piece of the operating system platform that runs on this unit. They offered Windows CE to the one laptop per child, which was turned down because it's not open source, and they wanted people that use the one laptop per child to have access to the source code to learn essentially how to build software, which is I think a great idea. So Microsoft and Intel started the Classmate PC to basically offer a competitor. I think it's slightly more expensive, but it's got maybe some more horsepower and things like that. Well, interesting that the kind of Microsoft can never win it at its own game because Mandriva has announced, or there was someone that announced that you can now get Mandriva pre-installed on Intel's Classmate PC. So if you don't want Windows CE, which why would you when you can have a fully functional Linux desktop? Why would you want a watered-down Windows CE experience? You can get Mandriva now on the Classmate PC, which is great. I mean, it really is, because the Classmate PC, I think, is still fairly cheap, which is still going to be a great option for schools. So I think it's a beautiful thing that you can get Linux on that bad boy. That's all the news for this week. This week we had an opportunity to talk to Mark Shuttleworth, the founder of the Ubuntu project, and Canonical and Ubuntu have some really cool things coming out. They've recently announced a new version of their Launchpad software, which is a great collaboration tool for projects, and of course Feisty Fawn is going to be coming out soon, so it seemed like just the right time to get Mr. Shuttleworth on the horn and talk to him about these great things and, of course, a bunch of other stuff. So with no further delay, let's play the interview with Mark Shuttleworth. And with us today is Mark Shuttleworth, founder of the Ubuntu Linux distribution. Mark, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a little about yourself to all 3 trillion listeners that we have listening today.
Well, first of all, thanks very much for the invitation to be here. I'm a 33-year-old South African, live in London. I have been working with the Ubuntu team now for just on 3 years. Before that, I studied finance and IT at the University of Cape Town and got involved in cryptography and digital certificates, and also pursued a bit of a fascination with space, traveling to Russia. I spent about a year in Russia working on that.
Definitely, and we'll definitely get into the Linux stuff, but that is... From being a big geek, that is a huge thing that I would love to do. So you stayed in Star City in Russia, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I was there about 8 months over the course of a year, and 5 or 6 months, 6 of those months were kind of full-time cosmonaut training, which was a lot of
wow.
Russian language skills, as well as understanding the Soyuz and the space station and figuring out the set of experiments that I would run while I was up there.
So can you speak some decent Russian then?
Да, конечно, но сожалению, я все забил. I'm pretty rusty these days. I've been out of Russia a lot longer than I was in it, but it's nice when I do run into Russian folks to surprise them with that.
You didn't happen to get a chance to visit their centrifuge they have there. I guess it's supposed to be the world's largest. Did you?
Sure, that's a substantial part of the training.
Oh, it is.
You have to be able to do 8 G sustained in the centrifuges. They have a bunch of them. Not just the one, although I think I know the one you're talking about. It's enormous, 300 tons, and it draws as much electricity as the rest of Star City combined. So it's they use it only for some of the more critical training.
So
their very biggest one.
You didn't get to like have anybody sitting there and push buttons, did you?
That's exactly what we did have to do, right?
You
sit inside the centrifuge, and then they spin it up, and you're supposed to go through a series of tests at various G loads. And they can test all sorts of stuff, right? You're wired, so physiologically they're monitoring you very closely. And they also do psychological sort of stress testing on you under those conditions. It's really, really interesting.
Wow, that sounds like a big challenge, but also kind of a lot of fun. I'm jealous, Mark. I'm very jealous. So while we're on the topic of space travel, my co-host, Brian, who couldn't join us today, emailed me specifically to ask you this question, and I think probably, you know, the trillions of Linux users want to know this too. Are the jokes particularly dirty in space? Do people tell some dirty space jokes when you're up there?
Well, sure. Cosmonauts are just another kind of sailor, so
right, exactly.
It gets fairly rough and nautical up there. But it's an extraordinary environment of camaraderie, right? Mm-hmm. You've got 5 or 6 guys and girls in a very confined space. You have to live together for extended periods of time,
right?
And you are very dependent on there being a sort of robust, healthy environment of communication. I benefited tremendously from the fact that some of the guys who were up there were very willing to sort of lend a hand and show me around and help me get stuff done. I had a lot to get done.
That's fantastic.
It's a tremendous, very collegial atmosphere up there.
That's
very
great.
Envious every time there's another launch, and I'm not on it.
Well, at least you did get to go. So let's shift gears and start talking about some Linux here. I noticed in one of your profiles that in the 90s you were a contributor to Debian. And I was just kind of curious, what made Mark Shuttleworth jump from a team contributor to the Debian project to actually starting in the entire Ubuntu distribution? That's a pretty big leap in my mind.
Well, the first thing I should say is I'm still something of a contributor to Debian. I just voted today in the DPL election, as it happens. I'm still a registered Debian developer.
That's awesome.
Like in keyring and so on.
Okay.
I see Debian as one of the purest expressions of what free software communities are all about. It's an enormously important distribution, and it's an enormously important partner for Ubuntu.
Mm-hmm.
And I see Ubuntu, conversely, as being broadly within the Debian family, right? We very much want to push the boundaries of what's possible within the Debian family, mm-hmm. but not exceed the boundaries of what's possible. And so while I would expect our relationship with Debian always to have its ups and downs and to be controversial, and since Debian is very much, you know, a collection of individuals, you're always going to have a diversity of opinions
there. Right.
I founded Ubuntu primarily because I wanted to show that the Debian infrastructure could be used to deliver something that was really usable, really functional, and widely appealing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not just to developers or to folks who historically saw themselves as being different from everybody, but from people who saw themselves as being, you know, just users. So I hope that we're kind of broadening the community of people who grow to learn about Debian rather than taking away from it.
No, it's absolutely... It's my opinion, a great combination of a fantastic solid Debian base with the with obviously all of the Ubuntu modifications on top of that make for a great desktop, and actually it's quickly becoming my preferred server platform too. You know, just to touch on the.
I guess I would put this slightly differently. I think when you build an organization, you have to choose what you're trying to create.
Uh-huh.
And if you look at the organization, you know, that is Debian, it is enormously successful at certain things.
Right.
And I thought for a long time about trying to, you know, redirect Debian itself, using my resources to redirect Debian itself, mm-hmm. to kind of optimize it for certain use cases. And I realized that would be taking something away from it. And what was needed was a complementary organization which is optimized to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully the combination is really powerful.
Well, I definitely think it is, and one of the things about, and I'm kind of jumping ahead in my some of the questions I had sketched out, but one of the things that really now is such a powerful force around Ubuntu is the community. And I get a question we get asked a lot by our listeners is, what you know, is it a chicken and the egg? What created the spark that just make the Ubuntu community explode like it has? And I figured let's ask Mark Shuttleworth that question. What do you think has been the primary driver to establish the healthy community that Ubuntu has?
Really difficult to say. I think perhaps a combination of things. The first thing was that there was a real crying need for it, right? That folks wanted a place where they could express their contributions to free software, and they wanted it to have certain characteristics. Mm-hmm. One of the things is that we did was make sure that all the early people who became kind of full-time contributors to the project were deeply aware of community-type issues. So the first 40, 50 employees all came from community projects, whether they were Debian or other distributions or upstream projects. They really understood and wanted to work effectively with the community, and they wanted to have a functional community. I guess the second thing is that we quite deliberately didn't create a kind of a distinction between employees and community members. There's no private mailing list. There's very, very little time that Canonical ever gets together, as it were, separately from Ubuntu. Pretty much every function that we have has community participants, and most conversations happen over email and IRC and happen on mailing lists. So community people feel like they are totally empowered to participate, and they may not, nobody gets what they want. I don't get, everything I want because it is a community project. But I accept that, and most other people accept that, and the result is something that we're all kind of proud of.
That's great. Well, let's talk a little bit about iCandy or Bling on the Linux desktop. Recently, we had Compiz and Beryl as two separate projects, Beryl forking from Compiz, and they've just announced that they're officially going to reunite after their rather public announcement of the fork, which led me to ask two questions, just based on some of the things you've blogged about. I know this is Desktop Effects or something you've followed. What's your take on the event of Beryl and Compiz getting back together? Do you think this is going to be a good thing for Linux desktops or a bad thing?
Oh, I think it's a great thing. It's really a great thing. I strongly defend the right of projects to split, but I'm also thrilled when they get back together again. And the reason behind that is simple. The free software is entirely driven by the willingness of its members to throw themselves wholeheartedly into it and to volunteer and contribute. And they don't volunteer and contribute if there are deep divides and stresses within the community. Mm-hmm. And so if you have a community that is made up of people who are naturally going in different directions, it is better to let them go in their separate directions. But ultimately, if you can combine forces, then many eyes make bugs shallow, and the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Mm-hmm. So while I really support the right of any project to split, and in many cases splits like that have resulted in very big leaps forward. Effectively, if you look at the GCC project with EGCS. Right.
And
X-Windows with the split in x386 to x.org. There are many examples of a fork like that being hugely positive for the project.
Right.
But in this case, I think it's great that they've been big enough to agree to get together.
Definitely.
I think that both sides have demonstrated a maturity and commitment to the ultimate goal, which is making sure that the desktop, the free software desktop, is kind of a hotbed of innovation. I've probably been a bit guilty of trivializing the desktop effects thing by calling it Bling. Mm-hmm. I think that this is one of the most important areas of innovation, R&D, in the desktop right now.
My co-host would very much agree.
Yeah. It's important to us to show that free software can lead the innovation cycle rather than just following. So the guys up at Redmond would love to make the argument, and do love to make the argument, that free software is really just copying what proprietary software has done before.
Right.
And to a certain extent, they're right. There is a race to parity. As long as we are behind, we see very clearly what we have to do to catch up, and we invest in going in that direction. Mm-hmm. The question is, what happens once we get there? And in many cases, what I've seen is that when free software equals proprietary software in functionality, it suddenly turns into this fantastic hotbed of innovation and creativity. Mm-hmm. And the great thing with the desktop effect stuff with Beryl and Compiz is that we're starting pretty much at the same time, as Windows.
Right.
And that means that we have a real opportunity to lead the way. That's why I think that stuff is so important. That's why I've been sort of trying to push it quite quite aggressively as a hot topic within Ubuntu.
I definitely agree, and I think a lot of our listeners do. So let's touch on forking for a little bit more. It does lead to some great advances, like you touched on the X11 and Xorg thing. But do you also feel that it can be essentially a liability for open source if projects fork and divide resources? Doesn't that overall slow down the general thrust of the Linux desktop?
Right. There's a distinction I would make between a branch and a fork. Mm-hmm. A branch is when a group splits, but it retains the ability to merge between the two kind of tips, if you want to think of it that way.
Right.
And I think Beryl and Compta has maintained that to a certain degree, right? There was a lot of code moving between the two projects, Beryl plugins getting adopted in Compta's and so on. And so that's healthy. When it gets a bit toxic is when you lose the ability to merge, when code loses the ability to move across, because then you really have divided the number of eyeballs, you've divided the community, you've reduced the amount of talent that can be brought to bear on sort of the underlying problem.
Right. And I guess that's essentially, the way I've always viewed it is it can be a liability of open source, but at the same time, it's sometimes a natural process of weeding out the good projects from the bad, too. So in the end, I think we're better off.
It's a very effective way of changing leadership. You know, what usually happens is that you get a project that has leadership that's not effective, and you have new guys coming along who see a different way of doing things, and so they strike out on their own. And if they're very successful, what happens is that when the projects merge, you more often than not, it's the guys who led the fork who sort of take a stronger position of leadership in the unified project.
Absolutely, yeah. So on your desktop, or at least on one of your desktops, are you running Compiz or Beryl on one of those?
Sure, I'm playing with both Compiz and Beryl. I would very much like us to have got to the point in Feisty where when you turned on Desktop Effects, you chose whether you were going to run it with Compiz or Beryl. But it looks as though we will, you know, especially with the merger happening, that's not so essential. And I enjoy it. I mean, I've played with a lot of the plugin and effects and managed to get my effects so scary that the desktop was virtually unusable, and then kind of pulled it back to something kind of smooth and slick.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. So I assume that Mark Shuttleworth, of course, runs some form of Ubuntu, but are you a Kubuntu man, an Ubuntu man, and a Zubuntu, Edubuntu? What flavor are you running?
I span both Ubuntu and Kubuntu. On my desktop, I've got Kubuntu, so I use KDE there. And I'm really excited by some of the KDE 4 stuff that's happening.
Right, yes.
And great to see that landing in Feisty right at the last minute. So that was very, very cool.
I didn't know there was some KDE 4 stuff inside Feisty.
Yeah, there's a sort of an initial cut of packages that's available, which is pretty cool. Obviously KDE, I think it's 3.5.4 or 3.5.5 is still the default, but
you have this. Yeah, the option. Though.
Kudos to the KDE community for making good progress in KDE 4.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we had Aaron Saigo on from the KDE project, and he had some really interesting things to say. I'm really looking forward to KDE 4. So
my laptop runs GNOME, runs Ubuntu.
Does it?
I spend quite a little bit of time actually at the command prompt because I code in VI and I'm in text mode quite a lot of the time.
Yeah. I actually prefer that method. I just find it so much quicker and efficient for me. So from an observer standpoint, Canonical and the Ubuntu Foundation both seem to be fairly well-structured. For example, you have a specific person assigned to a community manager and other positions and so on. Was it always your intention to shape things out the way you have with structured roles for different things, or has it just kind of been built out of necessity?
No, we very clearly wanted to separate, you know, Ubuntu and Canonical. I think it's important for the project to have governance of its own and for people to feel that there is both a for-profit entity and a non-profit entity and sort of a clear differentiation between those. So that's the approach we've taken, and so far it's been pretty good.
Yeah.
But the Ubuntu Foundation itself is really a kind of a backstop. If Canonical sort of never reaches internal sustainability, there's sufficient capital in the Ubuntu Foundation to make sure that that we can meet all of our public commitments. So, for example, 5 years of support on DAPR, and so on.
That's and that is for an end user and myself being an IT professional where I deploy DAPR servers. It's very reassuring to know that that there's that backing there.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it's essential if you're going to make a commitment like that that you have a very clear plan to deliver.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you think that just like within the Ubuntu Foundation, do you think that structure is necessary for a project like Ubuntu, or is it only when you get to a certain scale like Ubuntu size? So let's say you take the comp, we were just talking about compass, do they need to have, in your opinion, that kind of structure where they have well-defined roles, or do you think they're at a size where that would just kind of be a hindrance to them?
I think you know, it's certainly true that what you need is a sense of fairness and predictability. People need to know who's in charge and why. But that can happen in a small project just by virtue of the fact that, you know, two guys are leading it because they're doing most of the work.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knows that they have the kind of the moral authority.
Right.
In a project like the Linux kernel, for example, you have relatively little structure. But you have Linus as kind of a benevolent dictator, right? Nobody really questions his right to determine the broad direction of the project.
Mm-hmm.
And while everybody has their own branch of Linux, right, every kernel maintainer has their own little view of what Linux looks like today. But the consensus view is really what Linus has done.
Right.
So that makes things very clear and very straightforward for everybody. In projects which don't have that clarity, it can be difficult for them not to get bogged down.
Mm-hmm. And from the leadership roles, Linus can sometimes be a rather polarizing figure when he's talking about issues. And there was occasions where, blog posts that you've made or something about inclusion of proprietary drivers, you know, set one portion of the open source community on fire. Is that polarizing? Would you become a polarizing figure? Does that limit your effectiveness when speaking to the community, or do you think that that's not really so much an issue?
Well, it wouldn't be leadership if it didn't involve sometimes taking controversial steps or moving people beyond where they're currently sort of comfortable. At the same time, it's not constructive to be at odds with your entire team,
sure.
Nor is it constructive to sort of facilitate or catalyze arguments which can't be resolved,
mm-hmm.
and which make everybody fight. So
right.
I do see it as my job to kind of throw tough ideas out there,
mm-hmm.
and state very clearly which way I'd like the project to go. I don't always get what I want. So on the proprietary drivers issue, for example, we looked at it very hard with both the community council and the tech board, and we concluded that Compass or Beryl weren't mature enough in AG and even in Feisty to be the default switched on for everybody kind of
mm-hmm.
option.
Mm-hmm.
We will look at this again for 5C+1.
Mm-hmm.
Just a quick question: When is your show gonna be broadcast?
This will be out this Sunday, so all next week people will hear it.
So okay, so it goes out tomorrow.
Yep, you got it.
All right, then I won't announce the name of the of Feisty's successor. That we'll put that out next week.
Oh, Mark, that'd be big deal if you broke it on the show. Come on, that would be really big. All right, so that's something we're going to have to be keeping our eyes on. There's a planned name for the Feisty successor?
Yeah, there is. There is indeed.
Okay, and that should be coming out in a couple of weeks, or did you say next week?
No, next week.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you touched on proprietary drivers. Let's keep talking about that for a minute. One of the arguments was that for full support of the Linux desktop hardware, you know, wireless and video, proprietary drivers needed to be installed to fully take advantage of that. Where do you think that puts us? Do you feel at this point in time, in order for Linux being a free and open source platform, it's still reliant essentially on proprietary technology? Is this a bad thing in your opinion?
So the first thing I would say is I don't think it's important. What do you mean by full enablement of the hardware? I don't think it's important to fully enable the hardware unless there are actually free software applications that are so commonly used,
uh-huh.
so widely used, that we think they should be installed on everybody's desktop.
Well, for example, like the wireless.
The sort of essence of the debate that we had around
right.
around Compass. Sure. You know, yes, you need the cutting edge drivers and so on if you're going to play games, but not everybody does.
Right.
And many of those games are proprietary anyway; they're not free software games. Mm-hmm. So for us, the first question is, you know, how does any step we take, how does that actually further the cause of broadening the acceptance and interest in free software?
Sure.
I'm not interested in proprietary applications. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you need to run a proprietary application that demands proprietary drivers, well, then install the proprietary drivers yourself and install the proprietary application yourself. However, I do think we're getting to the point where there are going to be free software applications that we really do want to have on everybody's desktop that in turn do demand that we actually turn on that hardware. Mm-hmm. And at that point, which I think we'll hit with 5C plus 1, we're going to have this debate again. Now, Ubuntu's always taken the position that if there are free software applications that are hugely useful that we want on everyone's desktop and they require certain hardware to be enabled and that hardware is widely available, then we'll ship the drivers necessary to do it.
Right.
And so we're likely, again, to look at turning on the proprietary drivers in 5C plus 1. They've always been there, just not turned on by default, and that's what would be changing.
Yeah.
I am coming around to the idea that we should ask the question. And should say to people, you know, do you want this? You know, you can run it with the free drivers,
right,
or you can run it with the proprietary drivers. It's always our intention to try to support the development of free alternatives to the proprietary stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We've no desire to kind of increase the hold that the proprietary software world has on people. So we'll see.
Yeah. No, I
those are kind of the issues at stake.
I definitely agree with the fact that sometimes it's essential. Like for me with my work laptop, if I didn't have functional wireless, well, I would just run a distribution that gave me functional wireless out of the box. You know, I mean, I would have to have that. It's essential to my job.
Well, so, if it was just you, then we would say, you know, if that's what you need to do, then we'll lose you as a user.
Right.
But the fact is, you know, wireless and the internet are kind of essential functionality.
Exactly,
there's no question about it.
Yep.
So we've never had any controversy about the fact that we have included proprietary wireless drivers, because everybody agrees that, you know, a laptop that doesn't do it is no good at all.
Well, and one of the arguments that I've been making recently is that in terms of video drivers, it's getting to the point now where in a computer, the video card is by a large margin the most expensive component in the computer. And
has by far the most silicon real estate developed,
by far
the most transistor count, and so on.
I absolutely
agree.
It's almost a disservice if I am a user from the standpoint, and I've several people that I've converted have this opinion, from Windows to Ubuntu, they immediately are, well, what do you mean my 3D support isn't enabled? I have to have 3D support. That's why I bought my, you know, insert name of really expensive video card. I gotta get that. And so that one of the first things we always did on new desktops was download the proprietary driver for them, because for them it's just ridiculous not to have it, because they're coming from a Windows world.
Well, the other nice thing that we've done in 5C, which I'm very pleased about, is we've installed a piece of software called the Restricted Driver Manager, which actually tells people which proprietary drivers they've got running, because many people, you know, just follow a set of instructions on a web page. They don't really know that they're installing proprietary software, and they don't know what that means. They don't know what they're giving up when doing so. And so with Feisty, there's a control panel applet that basically will tell you that you've got these proprietary drivers, and it'll tell you, you know, essentially what you're giving up in having those there. We respect people's right to put that stuff on their machine, and in fact, we're likely to go ahead and do it for them in some cases, because we, by consensus, think that's a necessary evil right now, a bug that we'll fix, but one that we'll tolerate for now. But we're trying to educate people about what that means in terms of supportability, in terms of security updates,
I really like that,
support for other architectures and so on, so that we can actually build understanding amongst the broader community of users about why they should be asking their vendors for free software drivers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that Restricted Manager is a fantastic new tool that I fired up a few times just to see what I'm running on my system. I really like that. In fact, that's one of the new features of Feisty. Feisty's looking really great. What's the planned release date for Feisty?
April 19, and at the moment we are absolutely on track for that.
That's fantastic.
There's a bunch of fun stuff in there that I think will appeal to folks. On the end user front, there's the Restricted Driver Manager, and perhaps more interesting for folks who use laptops is stuff like the Avahi zero-conf wireless stuff with Network Magic, making it much easier to configure your wireless card and roam between different Wi-Fi networks. Mm-hmm. And Avahi making it a lot easier to sort of find out what else is available, what services are available on the local network, and kind of connect to other guys on the network. Mm-hmm. There's also a new Windows Migration Assistant, which let people who are installing Ubuntu next to Windows move across their Internet Explorer bookmarks, Firefox bookmarks, instant messaging press, and things like that. So some really awesome work that came in from the community and has landed in Feisty.
Yeah.
And then something that a lot of people have asked for, which is a framework to make it easier for people who have the right to run certain multimedia codecs to do so easily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unfortunately, we can't ship every multimedia codec to every country, and so we have to be quite conservative with what we put on the CD.
Mm-hmm.
But in many countries, it's perfectly legitimate for you to run a certain codec. And so we've created a framework in Feisty where when you encounter content that that requires certain codecs, it'll ask you if you have that local right to do it. And if you do, then it'll make it easy for you to just install that software and continue.
Yeah, that's very cool. I came across that. I didn't really actually hadn't read about that feature, and I went to launch a file, and it asked me if I wanted to install the codec. You know, one of the great tools would be for maybe Feisty Plus One would be a way to tie in with the Fluindo codecs that you can buy legally now for U.S. citizens. That'd be really nice because I've purchased their codec pack.
I know that there have been some discussions with Fluindo,
mm-hmm.
and I'm looking forward to their work sort of bearing fruit. There's something else for developers that I think is particularly attractive about Feisty, and that is a new framework for trapping errors. When an application segfaults on Feisty, when it basically crashes, it drops a log of what it was doing, and the next time you run that application or the next time you log in, Feisty will ask you if you want to send that log to us, and we can then pass it on to the upstream developers.
That's cool.
Obviously, you have to be a little careful there because potentially there's sensitive information in a log like that. But in many cases, that's the sort of information that can make a huge difference to the reliability and the quality of free software because we're essentially connecting the upstream developers directly to the end users and saying, this is exactly what went wrong, exactly what they were doing, and should, I think, really enhance the quality of the whole free software stack. And I think there are quite a few projects now looking to tie into that framework and looking forward to the error feedback that they'll get back from the two users of Feisty.
You know what I'm hearing? Things like the zero-conf networking and the debugger framework. I'm hearing a lot of frameworks and things like that. And to me, what that signals to me is that Ubuntu specifically, but just Linux desktop in general, is getting to a maturity standpoint. That when you start adding these kinds of frameworks like this, it to me identifies that it's gotten to a certain point, and that's really exciting, I think. And I think we're going to see a lot of that come to fruit in Feisty. So I'm really looking forward to Feisty. But I've got to ask you. I know all your machines, I'm sure, are running Linux. But have you gotten a chance to look at Microsoft Vista? Personally, I don't see anything in Vista that really catches my eye. But I'm wondering if, from where you're sitting, if you're seeing something that Windows Vista is doing right that you think Linux still needs to do, or you maybe do better.
I haven't used Vista heavily at all. I fired it up once or twice during the beta program under VMware, where it ran, sort of eventually got to run. But the machine I was running on just didn't have the resources, especially under VMware, to probably really show it off.
Mm-hmm.
I've poked at it once or twice in the stores. Gone up to a computer that has it pre-installed, and I have to say, kudos to Microsoft for giving it a very shiny look without really changing too much.
I think
people will find it fairly familiar. I think we need to learn from Microsoft in terms of consistency of user interface.
Hmm.
Obviously, Apple is even better, but I think Microsoft does do a very good job of establishing a set of design principles and then enforcing that across the entire environment.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, I think Linux makes a very credible alternative to Vista.
Oh,
it's,
yes.
Extremely reliable. I don't see anything in Vista that fundamentally makes it more reliable.
Mm-hmm.
I see unnecessary things in Vista that make it more complicated,
yes,
such as the DRM stuff.
And
it's just going to be really interesting to see how they balance all of that.
Yeah, definitely. And you know what I find is that there's things now that the Linux desktop does so much better than Windows did. Just like a year ago, Linux may be behind, but an example that I point to a lot is removable hard drives and FireWire and USB always work really great. But one of the things that I think the GNOME desktop really has is the tie-in with GStreamer in the back end. It is much more fluid than the tie-in with Windows Media. For example, Nautilus can preview a video file. In Windows Vista, when it previews a video file, it locks that file and you can't rename it or move it or anything like that, and it's kind of cumbersome.
Right.
So in a lot of ways, in ways people aren't really talking about, I really think the Linux desktop is beating Vista. So
it's certainly, you know, cleaner and more consistent and impressive. At the same time, you know, there are many Linux projects that could do better. I'm frustrated by OpenOffice. You know, it's our champion at the application level,
right,
fight against proprietary software, and it needs to really step up if they're going to compete. Office 12 is really innovative work from Microsoft from user interface point of view, and
right,
credit to Microsoft for doing that.
That's very true.
I would like to see similar sort of levels of innovation in the free software space. So it's not all rosy.
That's true. There are definitely areas we still have some work to do.
We can't declare victory yet by any means.
So big news came from Canonical this week is there was a new release of Launchpad that was announced. Can you touch on, for our listeners that don't know, a little bit about what Launchpad is?
Okay, sure. So at its simplest, Launchpad is the standard set of tools that you use to manage a project. It's a bug tracker. It's a sort of a project management tool. It's a code repository and so on. So much like what you would get if you set up Bugzilla and Subversion and some other things. But each of those tools is designed specifically to make it easier to collaborate with other projects. And the reason we did that, the reason we didn't just sort of embrace the existing sort of de facto standard set of tools out there, is because Ubuntu is a project that, you know, is really forced to think very hard about collaboration. We try and collaborate hard every day with Debian. We try and collaborate hard every day with a multitude of upstreams, and in many cases with other distributions as well, you know, and derivatives of Ubuntu. So for us, the ability to track conversations across projects is essential. And so we wrote Launchpad as our own infrastructure. And as of early this week, we started recommending other projects to evaluate it as well. It's not necessarily a replacement for your existing bug tracker. It allows you to kind of link your own bugs to the equivalent bugs in other people's bug trackers.
Very cool.
So the best example really is to imagine that there's a bug in Firefox, that you find a bug in Firefox on Ubuntu. And when you start Googling around, you find that the same bug is being reported and discussed in the Gentoo bug tracker, and in the upstream Mozilla bug tracker,
right,
and in the Debian bug tracker, and
common,
in the Red Hat bug tracker, just because users in each of those communities are experiencing the problem.
Right.
And what Launchpad will let you do is tie all of those conversations together so that you can have a single view of the status of that bug in all those communities. That allows our developers to be really efficient in the way they talk to the other communities.
Wow. So the new release is out, what are some of the new features in the new release of Launchpad that you think are pretty great?
I guess the first thing I would highlight is there's a revamped user interface with a lot more emphasis on branding and navigation.
It was very nice, yeah.
You really know where you're at. And each project that uses Launchpad, you know, has very strong branding of its own pages.
Hmm.
In a certain sense, Launchpad is just like SourceForge. You can host your own project there. You can't do quite everything that you can with SourceForge. We don't yet do mailing lists or web space, and so we wouldn't, you know, necessarily encourage anybody to abandon SourceForge in favor of Launchpad. The two complement one another. But the key functions are community structure. So you'll be aware that Ubuntu is really a collection of tens of teams, And so Launchpad makes it really easy for you to create those teams and have teams of teams and so on. So you can model your own community structure very, very efficiently in Launchpad. And then you can use that community structure in all of the applications. So for bug tracking, you can say, this team is responsible for that bug. And for translation, you can say, this team has the privilege to translate this package or translate this this piece of software.
Very cool.
There's a web-based translation infrastructure in there, which handles standard sort of Po templates and profiles, and means that your translators don't have to have any revision control access or be able to use text editors. They can just do it all through the web.
Oh, wow.
There's a project management infrastructure, and I'll take the bullet for any bugs in that because I think I wrote most of the code. And that we use that very heavily for Ubuntu to keep track of the sort of set of chunks of work that will go into each release.
Mm-hmm.
It's the tool that we use at our conferences to list out all the topics that we want to talk about, and then which of those topics is going to go on and form the basis of a particular release.
Hmm.
There's a support infrastructure, so you can get your community to answer new users' questions, and over time, as they answer those questions, they go into a knowledge base. So, future people who ask the same question get shown the answer that has already been established by the community. So it's quite a comprehensive sort of cross-project collaboration tool, and really worth checking out.
That's very cool. And where can people find that at?
Launchpad.net.
Oh, cool. We'll link to that in the show notes for everybody, too. Well, Mark, this has been a great conversation. Was there anything else you wanted to touch on before I let you go?
No, thank you to you and to your listeners for everything they do for free software. I think we're making good progress one day at a time.
Well, fantastic, Mark. Thanks very much for joining us today, and we look forward to talking to you soon.
You're welcome. Stay well.
And that was our interview with Mark Shuttleworth. Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this huge pile of thanks that I have sitting right next to me. I'm going to take this shovel in my hands, and I'm just shoveling a huge pile of thanks to Mark for coming on the show. That was a lot of fun to talk to him. I really enjoyed that, and I hope we can talk to him again. And now, it's time for some listener questions and feedback. And as always, we will start with the audio submissions.
Hey, Chris and Brian. This is Patrick from Iowa. First of all, great show. I love it. My question this week involves servers, specifically trying to get servers to be redundant. I've got a couple old Pentium 2 boxes lying around, and I thought it would be fun to put a server together and make it redundant so that if one of the boxes fails, if there's some kind of hardware issue or it just freezes up, the other machine can take over. I looked online and there are a few guides available, but it seems pretty complicated, and I was wondering if you guys had any suggestions or thoughts on the matter. Thanks a lot.
Okay, well, you touched on one part that I couldn't agree with you more. And this, getting to have redundant servers, depending on how you go about doing it, can be very complicated. So you want to avoid complication, obviously. And the best way to do that is to make it simple. And one of the things that you could always do, because really to have a truly clustered or to have a truly failover environment, you have to have like shared storage, right? You gotta have the two machines share the same disk. That way, if one fails, they can access the same data. All this crazy stuff, right? Well, you don't need that. You just want something simple. And one of the things you could easily do is, maybe this is not as simple as I thought it would be, but one of the things you could do is if you had an extra network card, you could throw in each machine. You could do a crossover cable between them. I'd make them have their own private network, and then just write bash scripts on each one. If you're familiar with Bash, it's actually pretty easy if you look it up online. Have the two ping each other or check for an open port or something like that. And then have an if-then statement where if when they ping and they don't get a reply, have a series of things kick off. If you're going to have it do web services, have the Apache web server start or have the Samba file server start. Whatever it is you're going to have that box do, have that process automatically kick off. To make things crazy easy, I've never really played with it, but I believe I have seen in the Webman control panel. If you're familiar with Webman, it's a way to completely remotely administer your system top to bottom through a web page. Now, it has its pros and cons. Some people have given it a hard time for some security things. Personally, used it for years on certain systems and never had a problem. So from personal experience, I've probably used Webman for about 5 years with not an issue. I don't use it on all my boxes, but on a couple I've used it. But I believe inside Webman, there is a heartbeat monitor module you can get that is specifically meant for monitoring when systems go down and then firing off processes. So that also is another route to look into, is what Webman offers. And I'm just suggesting that to make it simple and quick, because it's a cool project you want, but you don't want to spend 2 weeks setting it up. I get that. So that would be my advice for a way to do redundant servers, maybe in your home. All right, our next question comes in from Brother Red. Now, Brother Red has some obvious sound card interference noises that will give you a headache. So I'm going to play him a little quieter. And what you can do is turn up the volume, and I won't speak. So turn up the volume so you can hear Brother Red, and then I'll give you a second after he's done, turn it back down, so then I'll speak, all right? I'm starting that now.
Hey, Brian. Brother Red here. Here's a listener tip about setting up your distro to play Flash videos offline. A person can download these Flash videos with the VideoGet or Down Them All or download embedded extensions for Firefox. There are many neat videos out there on sites like YouTube, and one might want to save them but does not know how. The VideoGet extension will send you to the Flash Video Player site, where you can get that player and get some information about all of this at the same time. Like, after downloading, you have to change the file extension from whatever it is to .flv. The FLAV player, by the way, is portable for Windows boxes, so you can put it on your USB drive, as I have done, for the PC at the college or library. Anyway, for your GNU Linux box, you can install the FLAV player, or you can use mPlayer. mPlayer does not recognize FLAV by default, but you can change it. In KDE, you simply right-click on the icon of the file and look under Properties, and then click the little wrench thing, and then click Add Application. Now I have a whole library of Flash videos that I play through mPlayer with just a simple click. Most of the time, I will admit that the voice and audio syncing are a little off, but they do play, and I think pretty well, too.
All right, thanks very much, Brother Red. Although I noticed you didn't say hello to me. Chris, that's cool. That's fine. You go and download your low-quality YouTube videos and don't say hi to Chris. That's fine. I'm just co-hosting the show right now. I'm single hosting. I am a single host. There's no Brian here, and you don't say hi to me. That's cool. I don't mind. Whatever. That's cool. I'm fine with that. Why would I be upset about that? I'm not. Our next audio question is from a listener named Justin.
Hola, Chris. I was wondering what kinds of opportunities the migration from Windows XP to Windows Vista creates for marketing Linux to average home users of computers. Thank you. Bye.
Well, Justin, as far as marketing goes, I'm not sure where the opportunity is for marketing directly to home users. I do believe there, and I think this is something Novell is taking advantage of, that there is an opportunity to market to enterprise users, which could possibly. Sometimes you wonder, you know, it's chicken and the egg. Did Windows get a hold on the home desktop because a lot of businesses ran it, or vice versa? I tend to believe it's because businesses ran it, and then people wanted to go home and use the same interface that they knew how to use. So if you know, SLED and all the other distributions can get a foothold on the enterprise desktop, you're going to start seeing that translate to Linux at home. And I think that's where the migration to Vista gives us an opportunity, because enterprises are going to look at Vista and they're going to say, okay, what is Vista offering me right now for my desktops that do email, word processing, order editing, things like that? What does Vista offer me that I can't get from SLED for a fraction of the price, or that I can't get from Ubuntu or Fedora for free? And I think that's where we're going to see Linux definitely taking off. But in terms of marketing, I think that's one of the things Novell is pushing right now. But good question. Our next listener question comes from a listener named John. Now, John has some audio quality problems, but at the same time, he mentions it's his first time recording under Linux in OGG. So we're going to give him some leeway, and we're also going to play it because, and I say we, because it's just me, I'm also going to play it because, well, the content of the question / feedback is interesting. So here's John.
Good evening, Brian and Chris. This is John from Fairfield, Connecticut. How are you doing tonight? This is the first and initial recording on my Ubuntu Edgy desktop, running an AMD 64-bit processor, and I hope the audio sounds adequate. I sent you an email last week concerning the question about capture cards in Myth TV and DVRs in general. Well, after further searching on the internet and a little help from your forum as well too, there's a company, blackmagic-design.com, who makes an HDMI capture card. Now, not cheap, $250, but that's not horrible either. This may be a solution for the Myth TV project, so you can record from, well, in my case, satellite, but in most people's cases, I guess, cable, which actually stinks, but that's besides the point. just thought I'd drop that off for you guys. Oh, by the way, your show rocks. So, love you. Goodbye.
All right, John. Well, that's very cool. I did not actually know that they had HDMI capture cards out yet. I've seen component, but I have not seen HDMI. So that's very cool. And I'm glad that the forum at linuxactionshow.com/forum was able to help you. All right, our next question is text question from a listener. I think you pronounce his name Levi. Levi. Sorry, Levi. I don't know. Basically, he says, I've been trying to set up Myth TV. And when I'm setting up Myth TV, I'm getting stuck. I get stuck trying to figure out how to set up the Ubuntu box and the Myth TV. Well, Levi, basically what I did is I do run my Myth box on top of Ubuntu, and I did Ubuntu Dapper because I wanted the long-term version. That way I don't have to dist upgrade in 6 months and potentially break Myth TV. Or maybe I did Edgy, actually, now that I think about it, because I wanted the newer packages. Anyways, wiki.ubuntu.org has some great tutorials on how to set up Myth TV. Now, you were asking specifically about a pre-configured disk that you can drop into your machine and install. You said you weren't super happy with NotMyth. Well, we talked about it, I think, 2 weeks ago or a week ago. There's a project out right now called Linux MCE. It loads on top of an Ubuntu distribution, and boy, a lot of Ubuntu this week. And it basically sets up a media center for you, which includes some Myth TV packages. So Linux MCE might be an option. Also, you could also just try the wiki pages at wiki.ubuntu.org because they're pretty good. That's what I followed. I'll try to find the links to those guides are in some previous shows a while ago. I'll try to see if I can dig those up again and put them in this week's show notes for you. But that's the ones I followed, and they worked great for me. Scott writes in to reply to a voice question or feedback that we got last week about a listener that was trying to replace Aperture under Linux. He suggests that that listener might want to check out Digicam because it supports 16-bit raw camera data, which apparently is very similar to Aperture in Lightroom. So he says, check it out. You can find it at Digicam, DigiCam.org, and you might like that just fine. Okay, the next text question comes from Jay. Jay says, hey, Brian and Chris, I just read on Ars Technica that Apple's successor to OS X, OS 11, will be based on the Linux kernel instead of the BSD mock kernel. Do you think this will help Linux in any way? I would think that it would help Apple if it's true, of course. Guess the BSD guys don't work fast enough for them, eh? Always love the show and keep it up. Well, Jay, I think that was an Ars Technica April Fool's joke that they put out as fake news. I don't actually think Apple will be using the Linux kernel. I think Apple tries to avoid the GPL sometimes. I get that sense. I don't have anything to back it up, but I get the sense that they like the BSD because they can take the code and then close it up and not have to worry about, you know, things like contributing back to the community and whatnot. of course, which just seems very Apple to me. So I think that was an April Fool's joke. Sorry to disappoint Jay. Our next question comes from Guy. And Guy says, hello, guys, and thanks for the show. I was interested when I heard about your use of GIMP. I'm interested in software such as this to use professionally. I understand that GIMP has finally got native CMYK support. Oh, I did not know that, which has been sorely needed. Do you do graphics professionally? And if so, do you use any? Can you give us any pointers in Linux-based software for this? That was from Paul. No, I do not do graphics professionally at all in any way because I'm a horrible designer. However, I have direct family members that do graphics professionally. But I have heard that if you're trying to pick up GIMP, in fact, I got a comment about that this week. If you're trying to pick up GIMP and you're coming from Photoshop, there is a kind of a retooling of GIMP called GIMP Shop. And you can load GIMP Shop on your system and get a menu interface that's very similar to Photoshop. So if you're familiar with that, you might check that out. And that's great news to hear about CMYK support. That was one of the things I knew GIMP was really lacking from Photoshop. And that's the first I've heard of that. So I got to look that up because that's fantastic news if that's true. Let's see. We also got a couple other comments about GIMP Shop and so on and so forth. But I think after all of that reading and all of that playing, that's finally all the questions for this week. So if you would like to send us an audio comment, you can do that. And that is awesome when you do that, and we have a new way too, so let me touch on that. But first of all, the traditional methods are emailing me. For the next couple of weeks, why don't you just email me, Chris, C-H-R-I-S, at linuxactionshow.com. Prefer that you put your questions in the OGG format, because freedom rules, and you can send those to me in WAVE too, and if you do it in MP3, well, I'm going to make fun of you, but OGG is preferred. But we have a new way. It's going to cost you money because it's probably long distance for 99.9% of our audience. But you can call our new Skype voicemail box, and then we will play it back on the show. The reason why this is kind of a cool idea, even though it is going to be a long distance number for a lot of people, is Skype has some back-end technology to kind of clean up audio. So if you kind of have a cruddy sounding audio setup, you can call the Skype number and it will sound cleaner. Not perfect, but cleaner, I guess I would say. But you can call that at 425-296-7680, and you will get the Linux Action Show voicemail box. This is going to be a cool way to do this. So if people want to do this, they can do it from a phone, which is great. So if you don't have a mic, which I know we've heard a lot of that from people, they don't have a mic, you can call 425-296-7680. Or if you just have kind of poor audio quality, you can use the Skype out features to call that number and leave us something in our voicemail box, and we'll try to get into the next show. So definitely want to hear from everybody. Send us your questions. We need a whole new batch because I blew through them all this week, and I look forward to hearing from everybody. And then if anybody has any corrections to anything that I covered, please head over to linuxactionshow.com/form, and in the show notes for episode 42, you can post corrections in there, and people will read through that. And or if I answered incompletely, if I didn't give enough of an answer, anything like that, please give that information in the form. That'd be greatly appreciated. All right, listeners, that's all the questions and feedback for this week. And that brings us to the end of the show. Wow. You know what? Brian was right. It's tough to do a show on your own. I had a co-host. But the co-host got very, very, very sick, so he was unable to join us. And, of course, Brian's on his honeymoon for the next few weeks, so I had to man it alone. And I don't think I did a very good job, and I don't ever want to do it again. So I'm going to go ahead and wrap this one up, and next week we'll have a two-person show again, and we're going to kind of sneak in. I've been wanting to do this for a long time. Two different segments. The first segment is next week I'm going to start a series of what I'm going to call Beginner's Corners. So if you're new to Linux, or you just want to get some refreshed on the basics, I am going to be covering some quick segments that will be good, that would be best suited for new users to Linux, that sometimes maybe we accidentally talk over their head, or we go outside their comfort zone. So we're gonna start that. Beginner's Corner is what I think I'm going to call it. And then also next week, we're going to do some first-person shooter roundups because I love me the first-person shooters. Now, to qualify, I'd like these first-person shooters to be A, open source, and B, awesome. So if you know of some open source and awesome first-person shooters, I would love to hear from you. If you could either leave it in the forum comments for episode 42 or email me, chris@linuxactionshow.com, and give me some suggestions. I'd like if everybody could try to get them in by Wednesday, because by then I'm going to need to start definitely playing and reviewing them. And if you get them to me later than that, I won't really have time. So if you have some great games in mind, or you know, even if it's a great game that's not a first-person shooter, but it's open source and cool, send it my way, and I'll see if I can get it reviewed for next week. I'm going to be joined by my co-host, who also likes first-person shooters, so we'll probably do some network gaming and get a whole top-to-bottom review of the first-person shooters. So in the meantime, I want everybody to get in touch with me, because I'm so lonely without my co-host. You can do that by either emailing me, chris@linuxactionshow.com, or visiting us in the forum at linuxactionshow.com/forum, or there's also the IRC chat room at irc.freenode.net /Linux Action Show, which I actually made an appearance in there last week. All right, everybody. Well, that's going to be the end of this show, and we'll see you next week. Thanks for tuning in.
And I quote, "There is a huge difference between compiz and barrel. Barrel is a collection of workarounds to make things work now. That makes it a, all caps, huge liability. Compiz only implements things that are fixed upstream." Okay. Hey, I've heard this a great deal. Barrel is a liability because it implements workarounds.
Okay. I've said that.
You've said that. Honestly, people that I highly respect their opinion have said that. Some of the most brilliant developers that I've ever worked with have said something very, very similar. All of them are crazy, crazy, crazy wrong. Linux is a workaround. The existence crazy, Linux is a workaround. The reason for developing the Linux kernel is to work around the fact that we didn't have the source code to a similar type of other...
Right.
So, okay. And imagine for a second. Application A to add functionality in some way. Okay, this sort of thing happens every day. Every application sits on something else. Some sort of libraries, compilers, command line, whatever. Usually many different things. Application A has a bug. As every application and library in the world
has a bug.
Application B counters said bug in application A, and application B then crashes. Now, you have a bug in application B, which is can't handle the bug in application A. So you have two options. One, you fix the bug in application A. Now, application B does not crash because it does not encounter that bug. You are then working around the bug in application B. Because if you did not have application B, you would not have the need to fix the bug in application A. You could, of course, fix the bug in application B, and you are therefore working around the bug in application A. You can fix it whatever direction you want. In my opinion, it should be fixed in both. I like the idea of fixing both A and B. It's always a work. There's no such thing as making a fix to an application not work.
Let me ask
you're working around your own bug, someone else's. It's always a workaround. Chris.